This conversation on COVID-19 is made possible by Discovery. Hello, I'm Alec Hogg, and welcome to episode 12 of Inside COVID-19. Coming up, some much-needed hope for South Africa's COVID-19 fight. Research from a top United States university suggests the BCG vaccination against TB, administered in this country for the past 80 years, provides protection against COVID-19. More on that coming up, including an interview with Dr. Gonzalo Atazu, head of the New York Institute of Technology research team. Also in this episode, a US-based South African is spearheading a drive to get a skin prick COVID-19 testing kit into the market. We get a peek into how South African medics are preparing for the next wave of patients.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
First, though, in the COVID-19 headlines today, research published by Assistant Professor Dr. Gonzalo Atazu, a technologist colleague and four students at the New York Institute of Technology, provides fresh hope for countries like South Africa, which have long-standing universal policies for vaccinating against TB. A century-old vaccine, BCG, which has been administered in South Africa since 1940, appears to offer an unexpected shield against COVID-19. The NYIT report, which compares the COVID-19 mortality rates in 55 countries, found that the five which have never given their children BCG vaccinations, Italy, the United States, Lebanon, Netherlands, and Belgium, are experiencing COVID-19 death rates of up to 100 times higher than those countries which have long-standing universal BCG vaccinations. This thesis is further supported by evidence that countries like Spain, France, and Switzerland, which discontinued universal BCG vaccinations because of low TB incidence, are reporting much higher COVID-19 deaths than where vaccinations have been continuous. Other countries which began BCG vaccinations late, such as Iran, are also reporting far higher mortality rates. Lots more on that potential breakthrough coming up, including that interview with Dr. Atazu. Deaths from COVID-19 continue to rise sharply and were up by a third to 66,500 over the weekend. Italy, at 15,362 deaths, remains the hardest hit, followed by Spain, the USA, France, the UK, Iran, the Netherlands, Germany, Belgium, and Switzerland. Note, the bulk of which were non- or sporadic BCG vaccinators. In Europe, there is hope that the pandemic may have peaked. In Spain, the number of daily deaths fell for the third day in a row to 674, while French daily deaths also declined, and Germany reported its third straight drop in the daily rate of new infections. In the US, however, the curve is still on an upward trajectory, with New York reporting its highest number of deaths in a single day. By Sunday night, Johns Hopkins University's COVID-19 map showed total confirmed infections worldwide was over 1.25 million, up by 25% since Friday night. Around a quarter of these are in the United States, with Spain, Italy, Germany, and France now all above China, where COVID-19 originated but has been tightly controlled. South Africa's confirmed infections continue to grow modestly, totaling 1,585 by Saturday night, up by 80, or 5%, from Friday. This translates into a 3% infection rate from 54,000 tests that have been conducted. By Saturday night, South Africa had recorded 9 COVID-19 deaths, the last 6 all from KwaZulu-Natal, 4 females and 2 males, aged between 46 and 81.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
The New York Institute of Technology research, which shows a high negative correlation between BCG vaccinations and COVID-19 mortality and infection rates, is welcome news for South Africa, where the vaccine has been in use since 1940 and routinely administered to babies since 1960. The vaccine marks are clearly identified in older citizens, as it used to be administered through a 20-puncture head Heath gun. BCG was introduced in 1921 as a vaccine against tuberculosis after 13 years of research by French bacteriologists Albert Calmet and Camille Guérin, the C and G in its name. South Africa is one of 157 countries worldwide that universally administers the vaccine. In the interviews that follow, we hear from Dr. Gonzalo Otazu of the NYIT and, with the local angle, Discovery's chief clinician, Dr. Nolutandu Nemetswarani, and Dr. Neil Martinson, head of the Perinatal Research Unit at PHRU and an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University Center for TB Research. Well, it's a warm welcome to Dr. Gonzalo Otazu, who's with the New York Institute of Technology. Dr. Otazu, you and some of your students and a colleague have put together a research report that is giving hope to many people around the world, focusing on the TB vaccine, BCG. What put you into this frame of mind to have a look at it in the first place?
So I was surprised, as there were many other people, about the differences on how the disease was spreading. And there were very strong differences between different countries. In particular, my attention was caught by Japan, that had some of the first cases, but however, the disease has not spread as widely compared to other countries, another developed country like Italy, that has been very strongly affected. And there are many differences between these countries, but I knew that the BCG vaccination had this property that has been described before, that it provides this broad immunity. So when I look at the policies of universal vaccination, then it immediately jumped out that the countries that were being hit especially hard by the COVID-19 turned out to be the countries that never implemented a BCG vaccination policy. So that was what started this study. So we compiled a list as comprehensive as possible, given the circumstances, of more than 100 countries and compared the BCG policies with the number of deaths per million people. And then we saw these relationships. However, let me point out and emphasize that our study is a correlational study. We find this correlation. It's possible that there might be some other explanation. It could be, for example, that the countries that have a BCG vaccination policy, which tend to be in the developing world, might have younger population. We are doing now some analysis of that data to control for that. But those are the ones that we know. There might be other factors that might be influencing it. That's why it's very important that we wait for the results of the ongoing clinical trials, where in a control population with randomized, where some of the individuals will get a placebo, some of them will get the BCG, we'll be able to know if indeed there is a causal relationship.
Now, in South Africa, we have had BCG vaccinations going back to 1940. Clearly, in this country, there is concern, given the high HIV/AIDS rate, that's any little bit of help or any little bit of hope that could come through is very warmly greeted here. Is there a problem, though, that you might have had the BCG if your research turns out to be accurate, but HIV/AIDS is going to be more of a threat?
That's a really good point. In fact, the Center for Disease Control advises against the use of the BCG vaccination in immunocompromised populations. So that could be a factor that has to be taken into account. But let me point out something also that is actually very important. So although there are countries in East Asia that have managed to control the disease or have managed to reduce the number of cases, those countries did have BCG vaccination policies, but all of those countries have implemented social distancing policies, quarantines, widespread testing. I'm not aware of any country that just by having a BCG vaccinated policy has been able to control the disease. So all these measurements might complement the BCG vaccination policy. But again, we have to wait to see the results of clinical trials to determine if there is a causal relationship.
In the research report that you put together, you made a very interesting distinction between Italy and Japan. Could you take us through that?
Actually, I mean, we are doing a more analysis. I would like to point out some comparison about Italy and India. So one possible explanation that has been brought up is that maybe the countries that have been more strongly hit by the epidemic are the countries that have been hit earlier. So, for example, Italy, those countries might have been hit early, and the spread of the disease is going to be the same, independent of the country. However, if we look at the start of the first reported case, is the same in India and in Italy, although the number of cases in Italy are much higher per the size of the population than in India. So, however, again, let me rephrase this. This is a correlational study. We have to wait for the results of clinical trials to indeed know if this is a causal relationship.
How much greater per million people has the infections and indeed the mortalities been in Italy than India?
So in Italy, as of March 30, there were 11,591 deaths for a population of 60 million. Whereas in India, on the same day, on March 30, the number of deaths were 32 for a country of 1.38 billion people.
So it's many times for the non-BCG vaccinated country.
Yes, but there are many differences, and there might be something else that I'm missing. So it's not the age distribution, but there are other things that might be there. So that's why a controlled clinical trial is crucial to find out if this correlation, is this relationship, is a causal relationship.
What about the countries where the vaccination has been sporadic? And again, in your report, you then compared Spain with Denmark.
I wouldn't say sporadic. It was that, so what happened is historically BCG vaccination was used, but then in some countries, as the rate of the number of tuberculosis cases dropped, then there was a switch of policy, because if the whole population has BCG vaccinated, then this normal tuberculin test will yield a positive. So you won't know if somebody actually has the infection or if, on the other hand, has been BCG vaccinated. So countries switch to not vaccinated, and then you have a very sensitive test, which is the tuberculin test, find a few cases and treat those cases. So that's why some countries discontinue their policy. So Spain, they had the policy for a few years, and compared to other countries that kept the policy for longer times and cover more of their population.
Also, the countries that have only come to the party late with the BCG vaccinations, as in Iran in 1984, you make the point that's also supporting perhaps the conclusions that your initial report reached.
That's correct. The case of Iran, it has a universal vaccination policy, but as you point out, it just started in 1984.
So when you have a look at it overall, from the evidence that seems to be available from what you've shown with the United States, the Netherlands, Belgium, countries that never vaccinated, Italy, that never used BCG vaccinations, are the hardest hit by far. Is there any other reason potentially why this might be the case? Perhaps did they not practice social distancing? Were they earlier affected?
Those are good points. I mean, right now I'm in the middle of a quarantine here in New York, so social distancing has been practiced in these countries, and there are like developed countries, there are rich countries with like a advanced medical technology available to people. So, however, the death rates are pretty high. But there might be other factors. That's why a randomized trial should take care of all those factors that I cannot even think of right now.
And what kind of trials would they be?
So first of all, let me be very clear. I'm not involved in any of the clinical trials. So as I found these correlations, as we are submitting our report, we found out that there were actually other researchers that have started or were about to start clinical trials. So I'm not directly involved in this research, but these clinical trials are, as far as I understand, are using the healthcare personnel, which is now on the front lines, which are like being exposed to the virus, and to see if the BCG vaccination would provide some sort of protection.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
We're joined now by Dr. Nolutandu Nemetswarani, who's the head of the Discovery Health Center for Clinical Excellence. Nolu, it's always good to talk with you, but particularly today after some perhaps very encouraging news that the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine has done some research which suggests that there's a very good reason why we have such different mortality rates in the US, Italy and Spain, which are way ahead of the rest of the world. And it's got something to do with a vaccine called BCG or Bacillus Calmette-Guerin. Okay, now I'm really way outside my comfort zone here. What exactly is BCG?
BCG, I mean, is an old vaccine that has been incorporated into our vaccination schedules, specifically if you look at South Africa. This is a vaccine that we use to protect ourselves against tuberculosis, which is an infection that is quite prevalent in our setting. So it's usually given at birth to kids born to mothers in South Africa and other countries that also have these vaccine policies in place where there is universal vaccination against TB. When we grew up, it used to be almost like a stamp that was administered on one's shoulder or the deltoid, which is that muscle on the shoulder or the upper arm. And I think most recently, I mean, if I look at my kids, it's mainly a subcutaneous injection where you've got a little bump that forms around your upper arm, the deltoid. So that is really used, really protects from severe forms of TB.
Do many South Africans have this?
The policy in our country is that every child born in South Africa has to have the BCG vaccine at birth. So if you look at the immunization schedule, extended program on immunization, which we call it EPI, it includes BCG vaccination at birth. So most kids, by the time they leave the hospital, they would have been immunized against TB.
How long have we had this policy in place?
Sure, it's many years. I mean, if I look at introduction of BCG, something that when I was born, BCG was already there. You know, we were getting vaccinated at schools and all that. But most importantly is that right now at birth, all kids have to have the BCG vaccine before they can leave the hospital.
All right. So we are one of the countries where most of the population, one hopes, got BCGs. The research that now comes from the New York Institute of Technology that we referred to right in the beginning is very, very interesting in this regard. I guess there's lots of research all over the world. I did send you a copy of this report. Is it something that we can take seriously?
Any promising, whether it's a protective mechanism that relates to BCG or any other form of treatment that could be promising in fighting this epidemic, it's something that we will have to be interested in and also make sure that it is something that is well researched before we can make any conclusions. I think at this stage, there's still a lot that needs to be done in terms of research before we can certainly say that this is something that is going to be useful. I think from a South African point of view, considering that there is this universal policy around immunizing against TB, it would be a good outcome if there is really this protection that comes with this particular vaccine. considering also that obviously with our high prevalence of HIV, we are also worried about that. So if there is any hope of some level of protection with BCG, that would be great.
So just to summarize, and maybe you can fill in the gaps here, according to the research that has come out, the countries which have BCG immunization, and as you've explained, South Africa is one of them, have had far, far lower mortality rates than the countries which don't have this policy. And in particular, Spain, Italy, and the United States do not have a policy of BCG vaccinations in children. It does seem to correlate really well. And when you look at that from an external perspective, it does look like these numbers that the Institute's researchers have put together do make sense for people outside. Does it make sense to you as a doctor and a scientist?
Yes. So, Alec, I think what's quite interesting is that the analysis where it actually showed that the countries that don't have the universal TB vaccine program seem to have worse outcomes in terms of, you know, the infection rates and also the number of infections that are seen in those countries when you compare with countries like Japan and all the other Asian countries where there is some form of enforcement of this universal TB vaccination programs. So right now, still too soon to say that's the only reason why we're seeing what we're seeing. It does look quite compelling when you look at it, but there could be other factors that only research will have to give us these answers, because there are other practices in those countries maybe that are slightly different. There may be different responses to the epidemic that may have resulted in the picture that we're seeing. But there is now this BCG discussion in the mix that needs to be thoroughly investigated before we can for sure say this is the reason why we're seeing the differences. Very interesting, but I think it's still early days for us to make definitive conclusions around what we are finding in the data.
The whole thesis here is that this vaccination against TB has given the body immunization or a certain degree of immunization against COVID-19. What exactly is the purpose of a vaccination?
So we give a vaccine, which is usually a weakened strain of either a bacteria or a virus. So we talk about live attenuated in some instances. So we're giving a person a form of the infection to stimulate the immune system so that when you actually get to be faced with a real infection, your body has already developed antibodies so that it can be able to fight. And usually those antibodies are quite specific to whatever the infection you're trying to immunize against. So the BCG will be obviously immunizing against tuberculosis. So the immune response that you are mounting is really to protect you against TB. But there are some immunotherapeutic benefits that have been seen with BCG that extend beyond just TB, where there is some form of an immune response that is mounted that is protective on for other respiratory infections broader than just TB. And it does appear that it is protective, therefore, against some of these viral infections that cause respiratory symptoms. So I think that is the whole argument around BCG, that it has not just conferred immunity against the, it was intended to confer immunity against, but it has extended benefits that are being now researched to say maybe this could therefore be useful against COVID-19 as it also causes, you know, a respiratory type of infection.
Isn't it amazing, though? It's something that was never intended at the time. It was intended to fight TB. And here, out of left field, comes something that actually might, by accident, be protecting us against this very serious disease.
Definitely, definitely. Which is why I think this is going to be a very important piece of research. And I think it's going to be of great interest to our local researchers. And it's going to be quite an interesting piece of research, even to the countries where they do not have currently this universal TB vaccination program, where they may now start thinking about, I mean, in the absence of a COVID-19, of a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, they may now start thinking about maybe using BCG to actually facilitate or fast track that development of immunity in those communities as well. So it's one that we are also really going to be watching very closely. And we are hoping really for positive results in this one because it has got a bearing in terms of clinical outcomes in the South African context.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
It's a warm welcome to Neil Martinson, who is very close to the subject that we've been picking up on, the BCG or the Bacillus Calmette-Guérin vaccine. Did I pronounce it correctly, Neil?
It's probably okay. I mean, people will know what you're talking about.
Well, people in your industry, take us through what exactly it is that you guys focus on.
So my focus is on doing TB research, and probably as you know, TB is at the moment, the biggest killer of people in South Africa, and primarily because it's linked to HIV. And the BCG that you've alluded to is a vaccine against TB that everyone in South Africa probably has had. And a lot of us older people have probably had two jabs of BCG when we were younger. But now currently it's given to all children at the time of birth, except for kids who have who are infected with HIV, who don't get the BCG.
And the PHRU, of which you're the Deputy Executive Director, where exactly are you based?
So we're based in Soweto at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, and we have another satellite site at the Chapong Hospital in Klerksdorp, and some other smaller sites in the Free State and in Limpopo province.
So that you're on site, as it were, with the research that you do and presumably clinicians as well?
Yes, we do. Our job or our work at the PHRU is clinical research directed at mitigating the impact of HIV and tuberculosis in Southern Africa.
Tell us about this BCG vaccine, because there is very promising information coming from the New York Institute of Technology's College of Osteopathic Medicine to say that those who've been vaccinated as babies with it, which, as you've just explained, South Africans have been, might have a better defense system against COVID-19.
Yeah, so I think there has been some interest in BCG. So The problem with BCG is that it's not a very good vaccine in terms of preventing tuberculosis. So although we have universal vaccination in South Africa for many, many decades, still tuberculosis is an incredible public health problem. So this vaccine clearly is not making a major impact on the TB epidemic, particularly as it's been exacerbated by HIV. However, several clinical trials of BCG have shown an unexpected, what they call non-specific, benefit on mortality in infants. This was the one signal that people are trying to hang this COVID thing on, is that kids who received the BCG had the lower infectious disease mortality than kids who didn't receive the BCG. And even though the protective effects against TB weren't that marked, there was this sort of side effect, as it were, of BCG. So I guess that this is what spurred this paper that you're alluding to, which looked at rates of BCG and tried to relate the rates of BCG in each country to deaths due to COVID and also to the overall population rates of COVID. And essentially what they're finding is that the countries with lower coverage of BCG have higher COVID rates and higher mortality rates than those countries with higher rates of BCG. That's really what the results of that study.
From outside, just looking at the numbers, it's an irresistible argument to say that United States, Spain, and Italy, who haven't had BCG vaccinations, have got this very high mortality rate, whereas other countries, not so. Are we clutching at some straws here?
I don't know if I would be as strong to say we are clutching at straws, but what I would caution people is to take this, what epidemiologists call ecological evidence. So this is taking population level figures, drawing up some correlation between population level figures, and then drawing a conclusion that may be flawed because there might be other things at play. And the clear thing that comes out that could be at play here is that the stage of the epidemic. So if they had to repeat this same study in 4 months' time, they may find very different figures. South Africa clearly is at the beginning of its COVID epidemic. We could still reach for the stars like Italy, Spain and America have in term, if you look at the graph. So I think that might be too early. The second thing is that the coverage of testing, as you probably have seen and heard experts on TV talking about, the more you test, the lower your death rate. If you just test people who get admitted to hospital with symptoms of COVID, you're going to have a very high death rate. If you test a large number of people who may or may not have symptoms, the death rate, even though it might be exactly the same overall death rate, the death rate will be spuriously will be reflected as much lower than a country that it only tests people who have symptoms that are walking into hospital. I think for those two primary reasons, I would be a bit cautious about jumping to an immediate conclusion and saying, wow, this is something that we must start vaccinating people for. But there are two trials that I'm aware of that are either being planned or they've started. And one of them is being planned in Stellenbosch and another one in the Netherlands. But it's very difficult to be able to say from that sort of ecological data that we should be doing something more with BCG than we are already. And it might be that if there is a protection, that a second vaccination may add protection. But it might also be that if you gave a second vaccination at the time, shortly after which you would be exposed to COVID, it might not have an effect, or maybe it might even exacerbate your chance of being infected with COVID. So the vaccine world has been fraught with some interesting surprises that have been somewhat counterintuitive. So I think that doing well-conducted clinical trials is appropriate.
Neil, why is it that South Africa has had this experience of 20%, 20%, even 30% growth initially and then flatlined in the last few days, very low single figure increases in the infections? Is this a consequence, as well as what you spoke about a moment ago, of just not that many people being tested?
Well, I think that the rate of positives to those tested is extremely good. So I think that we have tested, when last I looked, we had tested approximately 40,000 people to generate 1,300 cases or thereabout. So I think that the testing has been appropriate for the scale of the epidemic. There has been a recent announcement that the testing is going to massively increase. And certainly there are testing sites where people can walk in and be tested. But still, the requirement for testing has been lowered as the epidemic progresses. But I think that South Africa, to flatten this curve, which we're all trying to do, or blunt the curve, really, it appears that if the initial announcement by the president and the stopping of flights from Europe, possibly both of those have contributed to the reduction of community transmission. So although most of the initial cases were from Italy and other parts of Europe, the real killer, in inverted commas, for South Africa is when there's widespread community transmission. The ability of the health services to respond to widespread community transmission at the time when we had our first 5 or 10 cases was really limited. Both the lockdown, which the effects of which we're probably starting to see right now in reduced transmission, as well as the reduction in European tourists and travelers, together with the initial restrictions on movement and restrictions on football games and restrictions on other mass gatherings, I think are now starting to bear fruit.
But what happens when we come out of lockdown? Presumably a second wave is possible.
Yes, I think that you'll have noticed that in Italy, Spain, and now in the US, these lockdowns have been extended. I suspect that unless there's a incredible reduction in the daily increase of new cases, our lockdown will either be extended or will be extended with slightly less restrictions on movement, or might be targeted for certain areas which are identified as hotspots for transmission. I don't see that 3 weeks of lockdown will be sufficient to curb the epidemic to such an extent that we can leave our houses and go back to normality.
There's been a lot of preparation by the medical practitioners around the country. Have we had enough time to get ready for it?
I think that we probably would never have enough time, but I think that the initial detection of cases and the sort of racking up of the government's response when the president first announced the lockdown, I think it really galvanized both the public and the private sectors to start taking this very seriously. And certainly there has been a combined response from both public and private sectors to try and rally all the resources that they can to provide more PPE, protective equipment for health personnel, and to get more testing sites, and to ensure that the economic impact of this terrible epidemic is not felt too much by the country, although I suspect it's going to have a dramatic effect.
Something which observers are concerned about is the high HIV/AIDS incidence in South Africa. And presumably that would make a lot of people, millions of people, immune or their immunities would be deficient, which suggests that COVID-19 be a major threat for them. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is this threat being exaggerated or is it very real?
No, I think it is real, but it is unknown. The vast majority of people who are HIV infected in South Africa now are taking antiretroviral therapy, which should provide some form of protection. The problem is in the countries where the epidemic has really taken hold, HIV prevalence is very low. The experience with people who are co-infected with HIV and with COVID is limited. And South Africa really provides a unique opportunity to ascertain what the impact will be. And I'm sure that the 7 million people in South Africa who are HIV infected weighed heavily on the president and the minister of health's minds when they were making this decision to have a lockdown. Because the sort of intuition of most medical people is that HIV is likely to have a deleterious effect on the progress, the progression of the disease if someone does become infected.
Well, you're there at Baragwanath Hospital. I think, is it still the biggest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere?
It's reputedly, yes. Mm.
Have you seen increases in COVID-19 cases?
There has been several cases. I'm not a clinician in the true sense of seeing patients as they get admitted into Barra, but I have heard that that they've had several positive patients. I don't think that they've had anyone who's been admitted to ICU yet, but I might be wrong.
But they're not being overwhelmed, certainly not at the moment.
No, and I think that that's what this lockdown has given them the opportunity to start increasing the number of beds, to try and gather resources like ventilators and to ensure that there are isolation wards that are separate from the general run-of-the-mill patient, and to try and prepare properly for the impending flood of patients if this lockdown doesn't work, or if the lockdown merely delays a subsequent massive increase in the number of patients with infection.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
As scientists race to find a cure and a vaccine for COVID-19, there are laboratories concentrating on developing antibody finger prick tests to determine whether a person has had the coronavirus. This would confirm that those who possess antibodies would not be able to be infected or to make others sick. That would enable them to safely return to work, especially healthcare workers who are now in self-isolation. The UK government has secured 3.5 million finger prick antibody tests, which it says will be made available this week via Amazon and pharmacy chain Boots. In the US, Stanley Bergman, a South African-born chief executive of Henry Schein, and a Wits University graduate, is also working on a fast antibody test. He spoke to our partners at Bloomberg, Carol Mazar and Jason Kelly.
Yes, so Henry Schein is the largest provider of products to what we call office-based healthcare practitioners. That's dentists and physicians outside of the acute care setting, in the private setting. And in that context, we have for years been focused on what's called point-of-care rapid tests. These are tests like the flu vaccine or even a pregnancy test that is conducted in the doctor's office. And so we started looking about 6 weeks ago around the world for what's called point-of-care rapid tests for the coronavirus. and give you a little thought, and that is that testing for the coronavirus is not like a pregnancy test. It's not yes or no. There are three kinds of tests that need to be used in unison to diagnose a particular patient. And the first is what's called a PCR test. This is a molecular test that is really good to diagnose a patient in the first few days, the first 7 days or so. The second is what's called an antigen test, which is early diagnosis, somewhere to mid-stage diagnosis, somewhere between 5 and 10 days. And the third is the antibody, which is a blood test, which is good to determine if you have had the virus or not. Right. All of these have to really be administered by somebody in a physician's office, or it could even be a paramedic, but interpreted by a physician. I'm not a physician. I'm not a public health person. I'm giving you a summary of what has to happen, what could happen. And these need to be reviewed.
Right.
An understanding of the patient's symptoms, the history, and other kinds of tests that have been done. These antibody tests are available pretty soon, and we'll be able to help patients understand whether they've had the disease or not.
Stanley, we think it's really important that people have an understanding of it, because it could potentially help us get people back to work sooner. It's about the presence of finding out if the presence of antibodies are there, and it means a person might be immune from getting the virus in the future. So that's key, though. We still don't know that about this virus. Is that correct?
Yes, but doesn't mean you will never get it again. I think these tests have been a little bit misunderstood in the sense that they sound very simple. You need to go through and understand what I just said and then speak to your physician. But clearly, these antibody tests, the blood test, the serology test, pin prick, no equipment needed, available in 15 minutes, are very, very helpful in bringing America back to work, and particularly testing the frontline healthcare providers and, for example, EMT and police people.
But are they 100% accurate in that if they show there's a presence of antibodies, that there is no chance of a person getting the coronavirus again?
Well, first of all, none of these tests are 100% accurate, nor is the PCR test, nor any of these. This is we're in the early stage of diagnosing this disease, and so none of these tests are 100% foolproof. Having said that, these tests working together can help the physician make decisions of whether somebody can go back to work or not. These are not tests that are foolproof. Unfortunately, we don't have any that are foolproof yet.
And so how quickly does this get out, and in what sort of volume, Stanley?
Well, we expect to have product production available. We have at the moment two, one being a Korean supplier and the other one being BD from the United States, and we're Beck and Dickinson, and we expect to have these products available in the next week or so in hundreds of thousands and then likely in millions. No, these tests will be available to physicians and to hospitals, and they can be bought from Henry Schein through our normal medical channel. I think the demand is more for the PCR test, which has been around for a while and known. And gradually, I think the knowledge about antibody serology blood tests will become known, and that the product will become more and more sought after. But at the moment, of course, we have not shipped any yet, but we're taking orders, and we will deliver tests to primarily we will focus on hospitals, acute care, and physician offices.
Stanley, as you know, the key thing with antibodies is that they tell us how many people were infected. That is the number who have recovered or have produced antibodies, suggesting that they have fought off the virus. So I'm curious if you have any idea, any results that have come back so far that gives you an idea of what proportion of the population is turning up antibody positive?
Yeah, unfortunately, these tests are relatively new. Testing patterns are not well known, but the test has been used, one in Korea and one in China, with pretty good results. But, of course, we have no studies yet of any scale in the United States. Studies are being conducted, and the public, many of them are studying this particular test and how to use it. But we're dealing with technology that's brand new in the United States.
We need to know whether this is seasonal, ultimately, whether we're going to be living with this for quite some time. So we need to know whether people are essentially, if not immune, at least have had it and are building up those antibodies, right?
What we need these tests to help us is determine patterns. and we can use these tests to help us determine what's the pattern of impact on society in general. And these will be very, very helpful. We expect them to be very, very helpful to public health officials as they diagnose or determine where the trends are heading.
South Africa is in full preparation for the wave of infections expected to hit the country in the weeks ahead. After a stream of deaths among health workers elsewhere in the world, the medical practitioners at Groote Schuur Hospital in Cape Town are taking no chances. Here, giving us a rare insight into the inner workings of those on the front line, is Dr. Ross Hofmeyer of the University of Cape Town. Ross, I've had the privilege of having a look at some of the videos that you guys have put together. It looks to me almost like soldiers preparing for a war. Obviously, you're not a soldier, you're a doctor, but you guys are doing simulations on how to treat COVID-19 victims. When did you start doing this?
So I'm an anesthesiologist here at Groote Schuur and connected to the University of Cape Town. And we've obviously been watching this eventuality of the public health emergency. It's now become a pandemic and a national disaster for us here in South Africa quite closely for quite a long time. In fact, we've had an eye on it since early in January. Have been slowly and steadily making preparations, which obviously now have been accelerating over the last few weeks. And one of those things that we recognize as anesthesiologists is that we're going to be very involved with treating these patients. And as a hospital as a whole, there's been a lot of coming together from different disciplines and figuring out how we're going to manage if we have a huge surge in patients, as our colleagues overseas have seen, and how we can prepare well for that. In anesthesia, we recognize that our skill set is looking after critically ill patients and patients who might be COVID positive who need to come for emergency surgical procedures. So we have, as a hospital, downscaled all of our elective surgery. We've been trying to empty our wards, empty our ICUs. And then on anesthesia side, we've been prepping very hard for treating these patients while keeping our staff safe. We recognize that probably our most scarce resource in South Africa in terms of the whole of medical practice is our healthcare workers, our doctors, our nurses, and all the allied professionals who work with us in the hospitals. So keeping them safe, preventing them from getting infected, which would result in them being quarantined or landing up in hospital or ICU themselves, is a huge priority for us.
In the UK, 1 in 4 of their doctors are now sitting at home in self-isolation after they've got COVID-19. So it's a very, very real issue. And we've seen quite a lot of doctors or health workers around the world who've died as a consequence of this, most famously the discoverer of the disease in China.
Yeah, this is a huge concern for us. And there are a number of reasons for concern. One of them being that healthcare workers working with critically ill patients are exposed potentially to quite heavy viral loads. And there's a question as to whether that puts them at greater risk than people in the public who are exposed to sick patients. But also we've seen globally a phenomenon. If we look at the Italians, for instance, about 8 or 9% of their overall infections occurred in healthcare workers. So that's about 1 in 10 people who get sick and land up in hospital are healthcare workers themselves. And that hits both sides of the system. That takes away from the practitioners that can care for these patients at a time of national need. And that also adds to the burden that they need to be cared for. So we take this very seriously as health practitioners, and we take protecting ourselves and our colleagues very seriously so that we can be available to care for more patients.
So that process, the set of videos that you put together, it starts off with what the healthcare worker needs to do to prepare themselves to come in contact with the COVID-19 victim.
Yes, indeed. And I think we need to be very careful and stratify carefully what precautions are necessary for people in different situations who might be coming into contact with COVID patients. One of our big concerns and one of the problems that we've been seeing is people who are in the community who obviously are concerned about being infected, going to quite drastic measures to prevent cross-infection and actually using up supplies that are needed by the healthcare workers. So we know that people who are in the community who are just maybe even under the lockdown, going to the shops, coming to contact with other people, the things that are going to prevent infection there are physical distancing, good quality hand washing, avoiding touching one's face, etc. With patients coming into the hospital, we have got what we call our standard level of personal protection. And that is if we're working with patients who may be COVID positive or who are known COVID positive. And there we know that the majority of the spread is through contact and through droplets. So we're taking standard precautions such as asking the patients to wear face masks so that if they cough, the droplets are arrested. We are practicing good hand hygiene. We're wearing normal gloves. We're wearing aprons, all of our normal contact and droplet precautions. But there's a very specific group of procedures, which we call aerosol generating procedures, where when we do those, we can actually, for a brief period of time, generate airborne COVID virus droplets. And those things include procedures such as intubation, which is putting in a breathing tube for someone coming for an operation or someone who is acutely ill and needs to go on a ventilator. And those procedures, we need to take very, very strict precautions in order to keep our staff safe. And so for those procedures, we're using the highest end of the respiratory protection. So those are the specialized N95 respirator masks, the disposable ones that you see us wearing, the head covers, the goggles, the full-length gowns, etc. So what we're trying to do is use the highest level of protection for very high-risk procedures like intubation, and then use stratified protection for the other forms of contact that we may have.
We're seeing that although there's relatively few deaths at the moment in South Africa, that they are starting to grow and indeed also hitting previously healthy people. So these droplets or the transmission of the droplets is a very significant part of the spreading of this disease.
Yeah, so you know, we must remember that this is a coronavirus. It's a lot like our other flu viruses that we see. And the predominant methods of spread are droplets, which are heavy particles which fall out of the air within a couple of meters, and then contact, and particularly coming into contact with contaminated surfaces. So, you know, the person who is not wearing a mask or who doesn't practice good cough hygiene, who might then wipe their face, get some on their hands, open a door using the door handle, and you come along, open the door, touch your face, and so forth. It's passed on. If there's somebody coughing who is, you know, at least a few meters away from you, actually your risk of droplets is quite low. But this is why we're suggesting people who are sick, who are in the hospital, we're putting normal surgical face masks onto them. It's those very fine aerosol particles that are generated when we do high risk procedures that require us to wear this additional protection like the N95 masks and so forth. And again, this is an issue of national concern to us that these might be inappropriately getting into the public domain and people might be wearing them because they feel it confers better protection, where actually that's taking them away from the healthcare providers who really need them because they're doing the high-risk procedures.
Well, I guess if you're in a hospital, the chances are people who come in because they've got COVID-19 or COVID-19 symptoms are going to come into contact with you first. But just to take it a little bit further, these training videos, how widely are you dispersing them and where did you get the information, or are there models that you've been able to pick up from elsewhere?
We've made these training videos here at Groote Schuur with the support of our Department of Anesthesia and Perioperative Medicine, as well as the Groote Schuur Hospital and the Western Cape Department of Health. The funding and the drive for this has come through the South African Society of Anesthesiologists, which is our national body. And SASA has been at the forefront of trying to raise the level of awareness, as well as create opportunities for education, as well as getting very involved right up to a ministerial level nationally, with sourcing more PPE, that's the personal protective equipment, with addressing the issues such as the availability of ventilators and working very closely with the Critical Care Society of South Africa on a lot of these problems. In terms of where we've sourced this information, fortunately, we are connected to expert colleagues around the world. We've been in discussion for several months, learning from the lessons that have been learned by countries which have had the pandemic strike them ahead of us. We've learned from colleagues and information coming out of China. We've learned from our colleagues in Europe. The Italians have been very efficient in sharing knowledge. So as clinicians, we've had a lot of online discussions. We've had webinars. There have been some early publications. Fortunately, we have networks of these colleagues. I've been able to pick up the phone and speak to my counterparts in the UK about their preparations. There's been a plethora of information, for instance, about the airway management that's featured in these videos. And a lot of expert consensus has gone into this. So we've certainly been able to learn from people overseas. And then we've also utilized our own local expertise and tried to come up with models that are available that can be used around the country. So, for instance, any practitioner in the country can go to the SASA webpage. We've got a sasacovid19.com is the resource, and our national guidelines for personal protective equipment, for theater workflow for COVID-19, for what to do with older colleagues, for how to gear up private practices to manage patients who are coming in with COVID in the private hospitals, to convert anesthesia teams to assisting with critical care. All of that is available on that resource. It's all open access and it's shared online. And the training videos that you're talking about, they went live yesterday, and they're available to be reviewed and to be downloaded and to be shared widely. And we're encouraging people to do that. There's an aviation saying that there's nothing more useless than the runway behind you. You just have to use what runway is left in front of you. I think as South Africa faces the concern that we might be hit hard, as our colleagues overseas have been, that we all need to be making every effort that we can to prepare now. And what we've tried to do is create those resources to help people prepare.
I guess the biggest concern or the greatest fear amongst normal citizens, ordinary citizens, is that once they get this thing, it's tickets. Surely that's not the case. Surely there is stuff that, although there isn't a vaccine, but there is a help that medical professionals can give you.
Absolutely. And I think people have been hailing the efforts of medical teams and medical practitioners at the moment as, we're on the front line. But actually, the most important message is we're not the front line. We are the last line of defense. The front line is out there in the community. The front line is the people who are getting frustrated because they've been stuck at home for a week. The front line is people who need to remember to wash their hands when they do their once a week grocery run. The front line is Joe Public, is the citizens of South Africa and the world who need to be reducing the spread, flattening the curve, all the messages that have been preached. So it's the people out there who are the front line. We in the hospitals are the last line of defense. We know that this is not a very lethal virus. Yes, it's not the normal flu, and people need to recognize that. We know from looking at the models of the countries who've been hit harder before us that particularly if you are young, fit, and well, maybe 1 or 2 in 1,000 people are going to succumb to this virus. We do know that if you take the whole population, maybe about 10 to 15% may need hospitalization, and they may need a little bit of support, maybe some oxygen and maybe some medical treatment. The vast majority of everybody else who gets it is going to be able to convalesce safely at home and is going to get over it like you would get over a bout of the flu. It's only a small percentage, somewhere around 2 to 5%, who are going to land up in hospital and needing critical care. They're going to need perhaps to go on a ventilator, but at least to have some kind of respiratory support. The great problem is that 2% of an entire country is a huge number of people, and it's way more than our healthcare system can cope with at one time. So that's why we really need to slow down the spread of this virus to allow us to spread out those cases so that everybody can get the care that they need.
And also make sure that the medical professionals are all themselves able to serve.
Absolutely. And, one of the biggest concerns at the moment, and I'll speak frankly, we as medical practitioners are nervous. We're worried about ourselves. We're worried about our families. We're worried about taking the virus home and transmitting it to our elderly parents who live with us, who are at greater risk. So yes, there's a lot of fear and anxiety, but with preparation and with planning comes the confidence to deal with this disease. The greatest problem at the moment is if people are unwittingly exposed to the disease and need to be quarantined. If you take a couple of people off the shop floor in the hospital, that immediately puts everyone else at greater risk because they're working harder, longer hours, etc. So getting them the right protective equipment, screening for contacts, tracing the people that have been exposed, slowing down the spread, these are the things which are going to keep us safe and keep us working.
Sounds like Cyril Ramaphosa has been listening to people like you, because what the country's what he's trying to tell the country is exactly what you've articulated now.
Yeah, look, I have to say, with the greatest respect to our president and to his ministers, we were all calling for a lockdown early in South Africa. There was a petition that went around from medical practitioners, and the president has called for a lockdown early. What we really need to do is to see people respect that as much as possible. And a great challenge and a great concern to us is that we recognize, because of the inequalities in this country, there are a lot of people to whom a lockdown is a huge challenge and a huge problem in our underprivileged areas, and to people who don't have the resources to sit in a comfortable house in a leafy suburb. So you know, how we can help our fellow citizens to isolate socially as much as possible, how we can support people who are more vulnerable in this time, is really where business and where the citizenry of South Africa should be turning their eyes.
This has been episode 12 of Inside COVID-19. Until tomorrow, I'm Alec Hogg. Cheerio. This conversation on COVID-19 was made possible by Discovery.